first speaker today is Peter Kiefer. Mr. Kiefer was associated with Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians for over 30 years as a recording engineer, producer, sound designer, production assistant, director of Waring Workshops, and company manager for the Fred Waring Show Tours. He's now coordinator of the Fred Waring Special Collection of the Penn State University Libraries. He's recently finished a complete discography of Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians, which has just been published by Greenwood Press.
Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be here this morning, and it's delightful to see so many faces. I don't know how bright you are at this point, but following the jazz crawl, I was hoping I'd at least get four or five people that were still walking wounded. Since I'm relatively new to most of you, I've been a member of ARCS for a long time, but last year was the first convention I went to and was kicking myself that I hadn't started earlier. But very quickly, my background, I've literally spent my life, I guess, with or about Fred Waring. I grew up in a house that played his records. And when I was an undergraduate at Penn State, I started as a staff assistant, which is a fancy name for gopher, at the Waring Workshops. And upon graduation, went on the road with him as a sound engineer. And so began a 30-year association. While I worked in Philadelphia with radio stations and recording studios, I was retained as a consultant for his sound productions, designing the sound for his shows and keeping that going. And I got interested in his recording collection. I always had a penchant for history. And in 1971, I went back up full-time as director of the Waring Workshops and got deeply involved in his collection. And then when he died in 1984, as I say to some people, he gave his antiques to Penn State and I was in them. I went with the collection because I guess I knew it better than anybody, and I have been at Penn State now for the last 11 years as coordinator of the collection, from whence all this material came. For those people, I know I'm talking to a group that there many of you know Fred Waring. I have had the experience of speaking to a lot of groups that didn't know the faintest idea who he was. I'll give you a quick rundown because a lot of people don't really realize the breadth that this man covered. He was a pioneer and a success in many, many fields. A lot of personalities were successful in only one area of the entertainment business. He started out essentially in vaudeville as a show band. He was in vaudeville. He was a success in recordings, in musical theater, motion pictures, radio, television, concert stage, and music education. The whole thing started in 1918 when four guys from Tyrone got together and formed a band, as kids do even today. They were a little different than most bands insofar as they sang. Most bands played, maybe did a vocal chorus every now and then, or somebody came up and sang once in a while, but singing was a vital part of their presentation and remained so the rest of his career. They played local concerts around the Pennsylvania area and maybe a little bit in Ohio and New York. But in 1922, they went out to Michigan to play a big, what they called the J-Hop. They were the third band. They were the overflow band. They had two so-called big names of that area that played in the big gym, and they were in a little room off to the side. And a couple of people discovered them, and they quickly became the hit of the evening. While they were in Ann Arbor, they appeared on Detroit's radio station, WWJ, and then were booked into some of the theaters in and around Detroit and became sort of a mild success. They were booked by Sid Grauman to come out to California and open his municipal theater in 1923, and were immediate big success, and then signed with the Victor Talking Machine to make their first recording in the end of 1923. The first recording was Sleep, which became and was at that time and lasted as their main theme song. Interesting story about Sleep. I was looking through some of the books out here in Kurt's exhibit, and in the book of American music from 1888 to the present, I looked up Sleep, and they kind of got the story wrong. The song was part of a piano composition that was written by a blind organist by the name of Adam Geibel from Philadelphia. He wrote hymns and was an organist, and Fred's brother Tom heard the composition and liked it and wrote some words. Well, they went to his publisher, Theodore Presser, to get permission to use the piece and to record it. And he was delighted, except he didn't want his name associated with this band of young whippersnapper jazzers, you know. So he made one stipulation that when the recording came out, that his name would be listed backwards. So that is where Earl Liebig came from. He took Geibel and put it backwards. The book out there had the story reversed. They said his name was Earl Liebig, and they published his name Adam Geibel. But set the record straight, so to speak. That's how the sleep came along. In 1925, of course, as we all know, electronic recording came along, and they recorded Collegiate, which was one of the first electronic recordings. Fred often said they made the first electronic recording. Well, that was one. They were one of the popular groups that made electronic recordings. I'm not sure that they were the first, but Collegiate, of course, was a big a big hit for them, and they went on to be a successful show band playing theaters. And in those days, of course, they, in between the movie showings, they had a big stage show, and the Pennsylvanians were the big hits. And this is a slide of a marquee. They did a prologue stage presentation to the movie The Freshman. And of course, it had the Where Pennsylvanians in those days were a very highly collegiate flavored group. In 1928, they went to Paris, France, and played a very popular supper club at the time, the Café de les Ambassadeurs. They did a review show that was written by Cole Porter. At one point, George Gershwin appeared with them. They did a Rhapsody in Blue with George Gershwin. His sister played or sang in the show, accompanied by the Pennsylvanians, and sort of started a long-lasting friendship between Fred and many of the major composers of the time. They came back to New York, cut their European tour group short, and appeared in a play, musical in New York called Hello Yourself. And in between performances, they'd run over to Brooklyn and filmed a movie called Syncopation, which was billed as the all-talking, all-musical show. It really was filmed prior to the Jazz Singer, but its release was held up. Jazz Singer came out first, and they garnered all the kudos, but the Syncopation came out shortly afterwards, and it was all done in between movies. And I guess there's a lot of stories. It was a very rough and demanding situation making movies at that time with sound, but it was a success. Unfortunately, to the best anybody we have found, is there a print of that picture has completely disappeared. There is nothing, we have nothing on it except print. If anybody has in their attic, which wouldn't do much good if it was in the attic, but if you know of a copy of the film Syncopation, we and some of the other people that were in the movie, Morton Downey was one, senior, we'd be interested in that. So then Fred decided he'd write his own show, and he wrote a show called Rah Rah Daze, spelled D-A-Z-E. It was a collegiate flavored and done out in California. The reviews was, a good show, but it was going up against the depression that was about to start, and just the wrong time. They said the right show at the wrong time, wrong place. He sold the book to Ray Getz Broadway, and I don't know what he salvaged out of the show, but supposedly he bought the book and all the music and then produced New Yorkers, which had a completely different plot and a completely different set of songs written by Cole Porter. But it was a big hit. Pennsylvanians and Clayton Jackson Durante, among others, were in the film, and Cole Porter wrote the song Love for Sale for the three Waring girls, a girls trio that he had. Even though at one part of the show it was sung primarily by a young ingenue of the time, but it was written for Fred Waring, and he made the hit recording, which was banned everywhere because it was vocal. In 1930, also, they did some shorts for Warner Brothers, and I have a little bit of a short to show you. It's from the short Alma Mater, we're going to watch two portions of it. They're rather quickly. The first is the group singing. You see the father of the show choir here. You see the group doing synchronized routines, which they were famous for. They did not just play on stage. It was a very visual attraction. And the young lady that comes out and does this marvelous dance, which is a good way to start your morning if you wanted to go through what she goes through, later, 2 years later, 3 years later, became his wife, Evelyn Nair. And then there's another short clip of a great synchronized song called The Drinking Song, which they also performed on stage. Scott? Here it comes.
Oh, we gotta have music. We're mad about music. All the music has got to be sweet and hot. Got to be sweet. Got to be hot. Oh, we gotta have girlfriends. We're mad about girlfriends. All the girlfriends have got to be sweet and hot. Sweet and hot. We don't care what tune, as long as it's a hot tune. Keep the heat in it, but sweet and mint. Oh, we gotta have girlfriends. Hello.
Hello.
I think she's sweet. I think she's hot. I think she's sweet.
I think she's hot.
Sweet and hot.
Give us a match. Hey!
the ice in the pail. No matter in senses reeling, pour up gin and a ginger ale. Bottoms up again, set them up again. We'll spend the night getting damn good and tight. Hail, drink it till your blood starts to heal. Drink it till you're made of the blue and the white. Here's to the school that we all love best. Give her a drink, give her a drink, give her a drink. We love her better than all the rest. Give her a drink, give her a drink, give her a drink. Just cockeyed we shall always be for our university. So to hell with the soup and the fish and nuts. We want beer!
That was 1932. Interestingly, my mind is a little bit risque for that year, the dance she did, and to say the word damn in a film in those days.
That was 334 before they really tightened up in the haze.
Oh, was it? Okay. Anyway, I never get tired of watching that. In 1932, the group went into the Roxy Theater, augmented. They were billed the largest Cinco Symphonic Orchestra in the world. They went in to do, I think, a four-week stint and ended up staying 6 months. It was quite an interesting gig for him because for the first time, instead of 20-some musicians in front of him, he had 50 or 60. And Leo Arno, who was a trombonist that joined the group, or he met when they were over in France, was in the group at the time. Leo went on to Hollywood and wrote a lot of film scores, and probably his greatest claim to fame is he wrote music for the Felix Slatkin's album called Charge, of which the beginning of that is now better known as the Olympic theme song. But Leo, who had studied under Maurice Ravel and people like that, really had to kind of teach him how to conduct a huge orchestra. And before every show, they would do a big prologue or an overture from some classical piece. And he managed to do that and insisted on memorizing every single score. He never would conduct from music when he was performing on the stage. And it was something he also passed on to the rest of us. We never dared to go into a stage performance with a piece of music in front of us. So it was a standard in those days and should stay here these times. At that same time, after the Roxy Theater, they started. He was sort of pushed to go into radio and start auditioning for radio programs. But everybody who said, well, what you do is choral singing, and that's best left in churches and concert stages. That never works on radio. Plus, your show is very visual. They went through 33 radio auditions. A couple of those featured an announcer or a stand-up comedian from Cleveland by the name of Bob Hope. But they kept getting turned down. Finally, in 1933, Old Gold. Not a cough in a carload. That's what they used to say. Sponsored the program, and it became an immediate success. And before the contract was over with Old Gold, the Ford Motor Company had enlisted the Pennsylvanians to put them on the radio for them. And they did. They went on the air for Ford for 3.5 years, up to 1936. And garnered every whatever awards were available at the time for outstanding musical programs. Around 1933 is when he stopped recording. He got mad at some of the radio stations, which I'll go into in a little bit down the road here. But after the Ford show, they went to Hollywood and made a movie called Varsity Show with Dick Powell and Sterling Holloway and the Lane Sisters, which were, of course, singers with him at the time, and Johnny Scott Davis was featured also. And the film featured a climax, the finale, that was done by Busby Berkeley, runs forever. But it's about a 15-minute huge. I debated whether to show you a clip of that, but I felt that had more important things to cover. But it was it pops up on TV still around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They play Varsity Show. In 1939 came one of the highlights of the Waring career. They went on radio for Chesterfield. And it was Chesterfield Pleasure Time, 15 minutes from 7 to 7:15 on the East Coast. And then they would do a repeat program at 11 for the West Coast. And in between, for the people that lined up and waited, that got tickets for the show, they would do a 45-minute show for the people in the audience. I have a little bit of a film that was made in 1940 about Fred Waring and the Chesterfields, and we'll look at a little bit of it.
This is Paul Douglas, your Pleasure Time announcer, taking you to the heart of Manhattan, where millions of bright lights tell us that the night shift of America's biggest new industry is hard at work. In the giant enterprise of keeping America cheerful and amused, radio brings pleasure to two audiences, the thousands who visit radio broadcasts and the scores of millions who hear them at home. And by commanding the largest audience in all the world, radio has earned for itself an outstanding place on Broadway, entertainment's Hall of Fame. Americans, evening is always pleasure time, but today pleasure time means something more. It means time to listen to Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians in a coast-to-coast variety program sponsored by Chesterfield.
First to create the combined vocal and instrumental group, one of radio's historic innovations, Fred Waring and his team are top-flight artists. Men like Polly McClintock, world-famous comedy drummer, one of Fred's original gang, and still its star performer. Among the many reasons for Fred's popularity are his unique arrangements of modern popular ballads, featured by the Pennsylvanians' talented and attractive soloist, Donna Day.
Okay, it goes on for, it was a promo film, obviously, made for, by Chesterfield. That was the Glee Club that was put together by a young divinity student from California who decided that he would much rather go into choral music, and his name was Robert Shaw. And I just happened to see a piece on TV the other day. He's celebrating his 80th birthday, of course, and that's where Robert Shaw started with Mr. Waring. Also in 1939, the Pennsylvanians participated in the experimental TV that NBC did at the World's Fair in New York City. They were the only musical group and probably the first musical group to perform on television. And we don't have any footage of that event either, and nor have I found any, but we do have lots of stills from that area. In 1942, he also resumed recording for Decca Records, and then in 1949, he went into television at the request of General Electric. He always wanted to wait until somebody else did it, and he could benefit from their mistakes, but he became the first big music organization to have prime time. They were on CBS Sunday evenings right after the Ed Sullivan Show. What an opening act. And they were successful all the way through 1955 when he sort of edged out of television and went back on the road, which was his first love, entertaining a live audience in front of live people. And he did that until the day he died in 1984. In 1947, he started the first choral music workshops, the first workshops to feature professional people working with amateurs and semi-professionals. And He continued that right up to the day he died. In 1983, he was awarded the Gold Medal of Congress, the highest honor that Congress can give to a civilian. Oops, that's the workshops at Shawnee. And it was presented to him in May of 1983 by President Reagan. And in 1984, he died, literally, as I said, the day after he performed his summer workshops at Penn State. Now, you can turn TV off. Or... Yeah. Okay. Since we are more concerned with the recording here, I want to go through his recording career because it spanned 1933 all the way up almost to when he died. His first recording, as I said before, was Sleep, and it's an acoustic recording in 20. The recording was issued in Baltimore, the first issue, and then that one day, according to the records we have, it sold 40,000 copies. I'm never quite sure whether it was in Baltimore or nationally, but in those days it was paramount to Mariah Carey's CD coming out and selling 1 million in the first day. And considering the band had only been really a national group for about 1 year, that was quite an accomplishment. We'll hear a little bit of their singing. Incidentally, in all the records that we've found, we only have in the collection one copy of this, the acoustic recording. They later recorded it in 1928, I think, electronically. And that's the one that pops up on all the anthologies. And we have a lot of the many, many, many of the 78s, but not only one copy of the acoustic recording. So we kind of treat that like gold. Skip ahead a little bit here. This was their first electronic recording, and it was also another huge hit, Collegiate. Some of you may have sung this song when you were going through your college days. We did in the 50s. It was sort of enjoyed a short revival.
Thing we never wear, and we don't have any use for.
If you ever wonder where the expression came, Ricky Ticky music, there you got it. Some great arrangements, and we have most of those in the library. One of the two songs that they recorded both acoustically and electronically was Sleep, of course, and then a number called Stackalee Blues, which they originally recorded in 1923 and then re-recorded in 28. And some years ago, I was doing a class, I put on a tape. Channel A, I put the acoustic recording, and channel B, I put the electronic recording with the same settings, so to demonstrate the audio difference as to what that innovation meant, the difference between acoustic and electro recording. I'll play a little bit of that. This is the acoustic recording, then we'll do a fade here into the electronic recording. Obviously, I made this recording before I set up my recording studio according to Seth Winter's specifications. There's the electronic. A lot more quality and a lot more definition. Pennsylvanians during the days did a lot of really wonderful, intelligent songs of the day. Another song that was a big hit for the Pennsylvanians is this piece called Ice Cream, You Scream, We All Scream for Ice Cream. One of the acknowledged writers of this song was Howard Johnson. Whether he actually did or he just gave them ice cream after the session, I'm not quite sure. Coming up is a solo on a very unusual instrument, Paulie McClinic, their comedy frog face voice, does a little jazz improvisation on his teeth. Thank you. try that in front of your mirror tonight.
Who did it?
Paulie McClinic on his teeth.
This is the last recording they made for Victor. It was a medley of songs from the show Flying Colors, written by Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz.
They were getting a little bit more sophisticated by then. Had ladies singing in the chorus, too. This was the period when he decided to give up, stop recording, because he got in an argument, a fight with the radio stations. Radio stations were all the artists were going through this. Radio stations would buy their recordings and then put together radio programs featuring that artist, selling it to local advertisers, and often putting them up against their network shows. And he thought this was wrong. He thought the record should be made for home use only, and he was one of the people that got the stations or the recording companies to put that on their labels, but nobody enforced it. And so he decided, the hell with it, I'll just stop recording. He also, around this time then, sued station WDAS in Philadelphia for this practice. And while he had the backing of all the many of the artists at the time, little by little, they sort of dropped out. They didn't want to antagonize anybody, but he saw the suit through. We have four volumes, huge volumes, of the proceedings of that case. He won the case, got an injunction from them playing his records, but the industry, so to speak, never followed up on that, and it was sort of a lot of labor going down the drain. In 1942, he resumed recording with the with Decca Records. It's interesting that in that period, the whole sound of the Pennsylvanians had changed. He instituted the Professional Glee Club, added to the orchestra, and of course, they were big hits on Chesterfield Show at that time. The first recording they made was with Paulie McClinic, Buckle Down Winsocky. Sort of a quasi-college song came out of a show, so he always was a great proponent of college music, and I guess it stands to reason that's why that was his first recording. The first album that they made right after that was a group of patriotic songs, and that was followed by albums of religious songs like Ave Maria and The Lord's Prayer, The Rosary, Were You There? Which is interesting because he always did those on his radio show, he was more noted for more pop music. I think you can tell the choral singing definitely improved with the addition of a professional chorus. Everything that they play will be carried away with a crutch. With a crutch. The Paulie's still there. Wearing the shield of the Dutchman. Shout hooray for the Pennsylvania Dutch. Hooray! One of the other big recordings he had at that time was Begin the Begin, a Cole Porter song. He and Cole Porter shared the same birthday, June 9th, and Fred always celebrated his birthday on the radio by playing the music of Cole Porter. They were very good friends. Cole often had Fred introduce the scores of his new shows on the radio program, and purportedly Fred was the one that convinced Cole Porter that this Begin idea was a good idea, and he should write some songs in that genre, and of course this became one of his best known songs. The Decca recording sessions, looking at the page of the first year that they went into recording, in January they recorded for 2 days and did five songs. In February, they did on one day they did four songs. March they did three sessions of 10 songs. April 1st they did 1 day of five. May they did two days of five. June 2 days with eight, and then in 6 days in July they did 20 songs. So it was a pretty competent group at that point. In 1942, they recorded what became his first gold record.
Mm-hmm.
this record, the single, and the album that it subsequently went into was the longest, the best-selling album he ever did. It was the most popular one. For some reason, after many, many years, Decca took it out of their catalog, but Penn State, we leased the rights to put it out, and it's still a big seller for us. When people think of February, and they think of Christmas, and Christmas is 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Another big song he did was the Battle Hymn. In the 40s, the song has almost disappeared into obscurity, and a good friend of his came to him and said, "You know, I've got a hymn that I think you can really do a lot with." And it was the Battle Hymn, and he gave it to his chief choral arranger, Roy Ringwald, who made the made this arrangement, and it is the record became a gold record. The print music has sold at this date almost 2 million copies of the choral arrangement. It's still being performed around the country. Peter Wachowski's arrangements, which he did for the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Warman Tabernacle Choir. Peter and Fred were really good friends and golfing buddies, and Peter told him, he said, "Fred, I admit I stole from your arrangement. It's a little bit different. It's probably good with a great orchestra, but Ringwald's is still the classic." This was another one of the best-selling records that he did, was Dry Bones. And of course, they did things like the Nutcracker Suite. A couple people mentioned here today that's a classic. Is the version with words, of course, and it isn't performed too much anymore by choral groups. But we get a lot of requests for that record. Give Me Your Tired, You're Poor. He premiered the score for Irving Berlin and on his radio program, and that's a big selling record. He introduced the score of South Pacific the week before it opened on Broadway at the request of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And we have a statement of Decca, from Decca, sales from 1942 through 1954. Segway got there before I did. From 42 to 54, the Waring catalog sold 26,545,214 records. So he made a lot of money for Decca. If only they'd be more cooperative with us when we want to reissue some of this stuff. In 1957, he went with Capitol Records and through the behest of Glenn Wallach, and they went into stereo. That was the segue that was supposed to happen at this point, because they recorded Dry Bones. And the first album they did with Capitol was probably, could be the classic Waring songs. It included Battle Hymn, Give Me Your Tired, You Never Walk Alone, Dry Bones, Motherless Child, Way Back Home, In the Still of the Night, Old Man River. We would love to reissue that album, but Capitol's financial demands are a little bit above what an academic university wants to pay. That was followed by Now Is the Caroling Season, which Capitol said was the best-selling of all the Fred Waring albums. And that's available on CD now. Capitol has released that in CD. And they did South Pacific, Music Man, Broadway Cavalcade. And Broadway Cavalcade was done in Delaware Water Gap. It was interesting. We did a lot of recording sessions, and I helped work at the Delaware Water Gap studio, and we loved that place. It was not a likely recording studio. It was an old theater in a resort, and it had wooden floors and tin roofs and lots of windows, but somehow it had such a nice warm feeling. And Decca, it was great because it was a residence. There was three floors of dormitories, and the Pennsylvanians could come down there for a couple weeks and record, and Fred didn't have to worry about him running off and doing gigs around town. But Capitol came in, and as engineers were wont to do, made all kinds of acoustical tests and found that room was just one of the worst possible rooms they thought that you could record in, and insisted that he do all his recording in New York. Well, he did win one battle, and did Broadway Cavalcade, which I think is one of his best albums, all done in a period of 2.5 weeks, down the Delaware Water Gap with a big Capitol remote truck and engineers who were literally tearing their hairs out because they had to do all kinds of EQ to make the room sound right to them. Then in December 1963, he went with Reprise, which was Frank Sinatra's recording company. And skip ahead here. And he did two albums with Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. Pennsylvania's had done a couple things with Bing Crosby, Weapon Proof Song and Kentucky Babe, I think it was. But this was the second time they were paired, and the first time with Frank. And they did two albums, one called I Hear America Singing, which this is from.
On your apple pie.
That's good.
That's good.
Mountain streams and fish to fry.
Yum, yum.
That's good.
Flag that you can wave about.
That's good.
That's good.
He also did a Christmas album called 12 Songs of Christmas, which is still kicking around somewhere.
That's good.
1966, he went back to Decca, which was then called MCA, and did several recordings. In 1971, signed with an obscure label called Mega, that was headed by Brad McEwen, who was a longtime RCA Victor engineer. They did one album of country songs, and it's just February in the country where it's not meant to be. His last actual recording session was in December 1974, when he took the whole group, 60 people, 30 singers and 30-some musicians, into the CBS studios and recorded a 30-minute piece that Roy Ringwald had written called Song of America, which was for the Scottish Rites organization. They were using that as a background for a film. Kind of running out of time here, so let me just skip ahead. He also did a series of transcription recordings, 305 songs in 1949 to 1950, which were not generally released. They were used as a transcribed series of programs which had moderate success. We at Penn State have a tape that we have culled from that collection called Sentimental Journey. That was right at the end of the Chesterfield, the radio broadcast days, going into television. And the group had a proficiency that I don't think any other group has ever had. They could sing almost anything that was said in front of them perfectly, at least 99.9%. And looking at the recording sheets from that time, just an example of the proficiency of that group. Today, you know, you go in for a three-hour session, you're lucky to get two or three songs. And April 27th, they did 16 songs. April 29th, they did 21. May 3rd, they slowed down, they did 14. In October, back in New York, they did 21 on one day, 22 days later. And the last session, they did 31 songs. He also did a lot of transcriptions for the Armed Forces Radio Network, Department of State, War Department, and the Treasury. The collection also contains just about all the radio broadcasts from 1933 through the 1949 days. And we are about to start a preservation project of that, dubbing them onto probably all of the above at this point. Audio tape, that tape, anything else we can hook up to preserve some of this stuff. Has a lot of goodies in it, one of which is 1934, George Gershwin appeared on the radio show and played two of his preludes with the Glee Club backing him on one and by himself on the other. And then they did a real off-the-wall version of Rhapsody in Blue, as the announcer said, with the cooperation of Mr. Gershwin. Mr. Gershwin was at the piano, and it was sort of half serious and half comedic. Probably the Rock Boys drummer was involved in the whole thing. I didn't really get a chance to listen to it all, but I thought, this is wild. But the fact that George Gershwin was there and let it happen just shows what a good sport he was. So I do have some materials if you're interested. I have a little brochure over here on the table about the collection at Penn State, a little photo biography for those of you that want to remember the man. And as Jerry mentioned, the discography Fred Waring and I put together has just been off the presses 2 weeks ago by Greenwood Press. I put some sheets over there.
Soothing music.
If anybody who is an expert on discographies would like to look at this and give me a real critique, I walked into the hotel the other day and I heard two ARCS members talking about a discography, and one was very chagrined that the discography he was talking about was just not done right at all. And I thought, oh my gosh, I wonder if mine's done right. I looked at many of them, and you know, there's no general format. Everybody did what they wanted to, so did I. But I would welcome. It's in print, and there's not much you can do about it now, but I would welcome any comments, because if we ever do it over again, I'd like to improve upon it. There are mistakes. I've already found some. They always pop up when we publish. So in closing, I just want to say that that Fred Waring was definitely an influence. He was sometimes forgotten. He's sometimes unknown, sometimes revered. Nonetheless, he was a contributor, a creator, an innovator, certainly a pioneer, and an influence on the recording and entertainment industry. So to use his own greeting, I want to say to you, Fred Waring, thanks for coming.
Who combined with a distinguished American composer and pianist, George Gershwin, to bring you 30 minutes of music.
Thanks.
Oops.
Our next speaker is